It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, China's leaders visiting Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow. We'll talk about the timing and significance of that meeting after the International Criminal Court just issued an arrest warrant for Putin. First, the ways we get to know our favorite athletes are changing. In previous generations, if you wanted to learn more about the players scoring your team's touchdowns, home runs, and jump shots, you had to wait for a reporter to sit down with the athlete, write up a news feature or television package, or wait for a quick biography to come out about your favorite player, as I once did with Detroit Tigers pitcher Mark the Bird Fidrich. But more recently, players have started taking the storytelling process into their own hands instead of relying just on traditional media platforms. It offers the potential for more unfiltered access into players' lives and personalities. Some media critics say it can feel more like public relations than objective truth-telling. I want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Where do you go to learn more about your favorite athletes at any level? Do you follow them on social media? Do you enjoy reading or watching longer stories about them? Do you want to hear them more in their own words? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Olivia Hancock is co-founder and head of operations for By Us Media, a new athlete-driven storytelling company. Olivia, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Chris Borland is a former All-American linebacker for the Wisconsin Badgers, also a co-founder of By Us Media. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Rob.
Chris, as a former player yourself, what has you so interested in creating platforms for athletes, in this case at the college level, to share their stories directly with the public?
Well, I think one of the overarching themes in sports over the last decade plus has been athlete empowerment. I think you've seen it with Naomi Osaki and other athletes kind of owning their narrative and sharing their story from their perspective. In my experience, I think while playing at Wisconsin and the NFL and afterwards, sometimes, you know, coverage was filtered through the opinion or perspective of the journalist that was writing the story. What's neat now, I think, particularly with young athletes, Gen Z and college athletes, is that they're content creators. They're used to putting out their story. I'd worked at the Players Tribune and saw some of the good that they could do there. And what Olivia and I want to create is a platform where athletes can speak directly to the public on what's important to them, what their experience is like. And I think really importantly to Olivia and I, it's easy to put your story out there by yourself. But we want to create a community where athletes can, you know, share their story with fellow athletes across the country. There's almost 500,000 college athletes that compete under the NCAA banner. So there's no shortage of incredible stories out there. And we want to create the platform where athletes can share theirs.
And Olivia, with all that in mind, can you tell us what it is that By Us Media is doing?
Yeah, so By Us is going to be a platform that empowers college athletes to share their story in their own words. We're primarily focused on stories that involve topics off the court or off the field. So rarely you'll ever hear about stats or scores on our platform. It will be topics like family, teammates, mental health, outside of sport hobbies. And Chris and I have been spending the last 6 weeks already traveling across the country, meeting with college athletes and capturing their photo without their jersey on. We've been capturing their photos and helping share their story in their own words. And we've already been to Duke, Oregon, Arizona State, Iowa, Iowa State, and others. And we're going to be heading off on another road trip in the coming weeks. So really exciting stuff, and we're just getting started.
I didn't hear Wisconsin on that list, Olivia. Is there a plan to come to UW-Madison, your alma mater, and other schools around the state?
Yes, there is. We have been to Wisconsin. I guess I look at Wisconsin as the home base. So when I'm thinking of where we're going,
Excellent. It's
usually we're leaving Madison to go somewhere else. But we do have some stories on the way with a women's hockey player at Wisconsin, and they actually just won the national championship this past Sunday.
Talking to Olivia Hancock and Chris Borland about their new project, an athlete storytelling company called By Us Media. Chris, You've already shared some of the stories online. One powerful one, an athlete with connections to Turkey and his reactions to the horrific earthquake there. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it was a basketball player on Drake named Okai, and a story that we were introduced to recently, and a really powerful one. His family, his parents grew up in Turkey, met there in school, and actually his folks lost some loved ones in the earthquake. And this was something that had been mentioned only briefly. I think Drake Athletics put out a video, Okai and a fellow athlete at Drake, a Turkish women's volleyball player, wanted to raise some funds and awareness. But what we were really fascinated in was, this had happened, this tragedy that Okai had personal ties to, in the midst of a historic run for Drake. They won their conference tournament for the first time. They were competing in the NCAA tournament. And it was just something that he was trying to juggle in his life. And I think that's kind of the power and importance of what we want to accomplish. It's really that what athletes are experiencing personally. His was a dramatic example. We'll have another story out tomorrow on a women's basketball player from Iowa State who helped start South Sudan women's national basketball team. Just an amazing person. And she wrote about identity, trying to fit in while often sticking out, mental health, and just the reminder that she's a human first. I think she's done a lot of wonderful things in her life and can be kind of cast as a hero or a symbol for something, but just really wanted to focus on her mental health. So there's so many incredible stories. Not all are so heavy. There's some lighter and fun ones, but that's the reality of college sports. There's hundreds of thousands of different experiences, and we want to kind of let fans in and see what each are like.
And Olivia, if I'm hearing this right, the goal is not we're going to find the biggest stars in the biggest sports, and profile the Heisman Trophy contenders and things like that. You're trying to get a broad cross-section of the people involved in college athletics. Do I have that about right?
Yes, you are definitely correct there. Chris just mentioned two basketball players, one that plays for a men's team and one that plays for a women's. But coming up, we have stories from cross-country runners and even from a women's wrestler. Iowa has the first Power Five Conference women's wrestling team. So we will be sharing stories of tennis players, wrestlers, runners, really any sport that is in college sports. So definitely excited to be bringing a diverse array of storytellers to the table.
Chris, I wonder about generational change here. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that you were a college player, but now you're talking to athletes who really grew up in the social media world with the concept of people really presenting their own image. Are you hoping to capture some of that, that attitude?
Yeah, I don't know if it's the attitude. I graduated just 9 years ago, and in that time, so much has changed. Mm-hmm. I think young people, even if you aren't an athlete, it's so hard to grow up in the era of social media. Everything you do is observed, watched, talked about by your peers on social media. And I think that the volume is turned up on that when it comes to athletes. The recruiting process, your play on the field, anything you do off the field is kind of under a microscope. So that's come up with every athlete we've talked to. The mental health challenges associated with that have often come up as well. So a few things that we want to accomplish is, humanizing these young people. I think it's easy for fans to forget that they're complex individuals that are living lives outside of their performance on and off the field. So that's one thing that we're fascinated by. And I think also providing a healthier image for young people. Our readership, our viewership will, be as young as preteens and teenagers. And to see an athlete that you idolize be vulnerable, be honest, be earnest, I think there's a lot of power in that. And I think young people that read our stories, we're able to see themselves in the athletes that are sharing stories outside of the court, outside of the field.
And Olivia, as the two of you roam the land talking to athletes, are you getting a lot of enthusiasm from the college athletes you talk to, a willingness and excitement to share their stories?
Yes, we are. They've, I think, just been so energized and refreshed to hear that a platform like this exists. Chris has talked a little bit about the community that we're creating, but I think athletes have, and college athletes specifically, have often been told what to say, you know, how to say it. And now they feel really empowered and excited to share their story in their own words. These are multifaceted individuals, and to have a platform that they can share stories and experiences outside of sport, I think is a really new thing for them. And we've seen an incredible reception so far from the athletes themselves.
Chris, I could see an athlete being concerned, given, as you were saying, they're under the microscope. If they say the wrong thing, it could really come back to haunt them very quickly. How do you and the athletes you talk to navigate that?
Well, we take our time. I think we've all seen athletes interviewed immediately after a big win or loss, and they might be in the locker room and still feeling those emotions and say something they regret. Olivia and my approach has been to work with athletes. They draft what they want to say. If they want feedback, we can provide it. But we're in no rush. I think one of my frustrations at times being covered as an athlete was, you know, being maybe the quote that I didn't want in was the one that was included, or, you know, how I said something maybe wasn't what I meant on video. So we're patient with athletes and let them entirely control what they want to say. And, you know, I think that's been, like Olivia said, something that's refreshing. It's, you know, athletes can really take their time and think about the story that they want to share exactly how they want to. They are under, you know, pressure. I think there's a, there's so many cliches in sports about not wanting to be a distraction or putting the team first. But what we see more and more, and I think this is close to recruiting, is that young athletes that are used to, you know, being on social media, sharing their story, want to go to a place where they can be themselves and be supported. So even with athletic departments that we've spoken with, understand the importance of the idea. And I think it's just the new media landscape in college sports. It's going to be about elevating athletes' stories and not as controlling as it's been in the past.
We'll leave it there. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Rob.
And Olivia, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Rob.
Olivia Hancock and Chris Borland are co-founders of a new athlete storytelling company, By Us Media. Olivia is a UW-Madison graduate. Chris played linebacker for the UW-Madison Badgers. They're with us today to talk about players using their own platforms to tell their stories instead of relying on traditional media. Up next, UW-Milwaukee sports media professor joins us for a look at the broader trend among players and what it means for the types of stories fans get to hear. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you and do you want to learn more about your favorite players? Do you follow athletes at any level on social media to get that direct contact? Do you want to hear more of their off-the-field stories? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about how we get to know our favorite athletes, why many of them are switching to their own storytelling platforms instead of relying just on traditional news media. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you follow any kind of media to hear the personal stories, the life stories of athletes at any level? If so, where do you go for that? A newspaper, a news website, a sports website, or these platforms where athletes tell their own stories? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michael Meyer is a visiting assistant professor of journalism at UW-Milwaukee, where he teaches about sports media. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Pleasure to be here.
Michael, we just heard about this By Us effort here in Wisconsin. It's not the first platform trying to help athletes go direct to people with their own stories. What do you make of this trend, if it is a trend?
Well, it certainly is a trend. I think people are interested in taking advantage of the ability to speak directly to audiences. Pro athletes have done this for a long time. Now that college athletes are sort of able to monetize their personal images, I think it's becoming a more pressing question for college athletes, because the NCAA just, you know, stopped punishing student athletes for name, image, and likeness violations, right? They can now promote products. So developing a public persona and being able to speak outside of a media apparatus, I think, is of increasing value to college athletes.
Now, journalistically, I think, okay, for a politician, you know, if I'm a politician, of course, I want to be able to speak without the media intervening, but that may not necessarily be a public good, right? You want politicians to be challenged by, you know, some kind of third party from time to time. Is there any harm if we're talking about athletes instead of politicians?
So I think for both athletes and politicians, we should understand that they are speaking from a context, right? Athletes are telling, you know, athletes have a perspective and politicians have a perspective. The fact that they can say things does not mean that we should specifically believe them, right? So, you know, a politician goes on TV, an athlete makes a public statement, right? We as an audience have the right to, you know, subject that to our reasoned analysis and criticize it if we find their statement lacking. We love having, you know, when journalists were in control, the idea that sort of bad ideas never got through is not, you know, that's not true, right? We're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, and certainly reporting failed in some cases there. Wrong information made it through, right? The presence of journalists, sadly, as I say this as a former journalist, doesn't guarantee us anything.
Right. I think of the old days of sports with all the myth-making and, you know, kind of creating characters like Yogi Berra and Babe Ruth that were not necessarily real versions of who they are. Has traditional sports media gotten a little better, a little more authentic over the years, do you think?
I think it is. So there was a pushback in, you know, even at the time for the people who were building these people as like major symbols. If you go back and read sports journalism history, there's this divide between gee whiz and aw nut sports writers. And the gee whizers were the ones who, you know, wanted to turn athletes into symbols. But as the famous sports writer Robert Libsite said, you know, gilding the lily is not good to the lily, right? The flower dies. Making athletes into symbols didn't actually do the athletes any favors. It is dehumanizing on some level. It has us sort of turning them into symbols that we can use rather than understanding the athlete as a fully-blooded human being.
Now, I also asked them about, and I don't want to hear you talk about this, the potential minefields. Athletes do get a lot of attention. They're responsible to themselves, their team, their teammates. Does it make sense in some cases for athletes to not want to take these kind of chances and put themselves out there like this?
I mean, for any media platform, you expect that some athletes are going to get themselves into trouble, right? I remember a few years ago, Pat Connaughton of the Milwaukee Bucks got in trouble for a cameo video that he made, right? It's a sort of fan service website. So people are going to get themselves in trouble, and managing media dynamics, though, is part of college sports, right? Especially at the higher levels, especially for sports that do generate a lot of media coverage. So there are going to be minefields. This is a new avenue for college sports to have to sort of contend with.
What about those athletes who aren't in those high profile sports and high profile programs? Do you see this as an opportunity for the public to learn more about their lives and for them to share a little piece of themselves?
I do. I think one of the things that we have seen in just the last couple of years as athletes have started to be able to sign endorsement deals, that it's not just football players and men's basketball players getting those deals, right? Athletes from all over the sporting landscape have been able to sort of make those connections with the public. Now, there are lots of sort of elements in there that we can debate and discuss in terms of racial dynamics, gender dynamics, but ultimately, right, it's this opening up of the media landscape does enable more participants, right? For good and for ill, it enables more participants. I think in this case, that we're hearing from people beyond just the traditional men's basketball, football duality, I think is probably a positive.
Any kind of media we talk about now faces challenges on the money side of things, the changing nature of advertising in print or on TV or online or what have you. This kind of stuff is no exception. Players Tribune, who feature direct stories from athletes, not a roaring success. They've had some good stuff. This new thing by us, no guarantee of success. What do you think is going to make the difference for the survival and thriving of an athlete-centered platform like this?
I mean, it's going to be adoption, right? It's going to be people sort of coming to it. It's going to be the ability for the platform to generate conversation, to put ideas in front of people, to get them to think about these things and discuss them. But the revenue side is a challenge for everything in media, even something like this. So, you know, I wish them the best of luck, because I think it's an exciting idea, to sort of make sure that like the range of college athletes are able to speak. I covered college sports for 6 years before I went on this academic path, and there are a lot of great stories and there's not enough time to tell them. And so it's going to be great to be able to hear from other people. And so the challenge will be sort of figuring out how to manage branding, how to manage advertising, how to sort of bring in enough money to keep the platform going.
As somebody who watches this, as someone who used to report on college athletics, what kind of stories, however they're presented, would you like to see more of?
You know, I want to see more of the, I'm a sucker for the behind the scenes stuff, the challenges that athletes face on a day-to-day basis. I think that stuff is really fascinating. So just the way you manage your life, like I'm sort of, that's what I'm interested in. But I'm also interested in this, you know, the college experience is so alienating for somebody who's not also devoting 20 hours to sports, right? You're dropping down in a new location, you're meeting new people, you're embedded in a new community, right? Like, that's not a story we hear, right? That, you know, everything is sort of rooted, you know, the media apparatus is geared around toward game coverage and describing what happened in the game, right? This understanding what the challenges are on a daily basis. Like, I think that insight is the stuff that I was always most fascinated by.
And we'll thank our guest, Michael Meyer, visiting assistant professor of journalism at UW-Milwaukee, where he teaches about sports media. He was with us today for a look at athlete-centered storytelling platforms. Coming up, a look at international criminal court charges against Russian dictator Vladimir Putin. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we explore the history of what our guest calls free market fundamentalism with the co-author of The Big Myth, How American Business Taught Us to Loathe Government and Love the Free Market. Now, the International Criminal Court last Friday issued arrest warrants for Russia's President Vladimir Putin, along with the Russian Federation's Children's Commissioner. The ICC war crimes charges are a response to the deportation of thousands of Ukrainian children to Russia. Here's ICC President Pyotr Hofmansky in a video statement.
It is forbidden by international law for occupying powers to transfer civilians from the territory they live in to other territories. Children enjoy special protection under the Geneva Convention.
We're going to talk about the charges and whether Putin could actually be arrested. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about this move by the International Criminal Court, about how war crime charges are brought and prosecuted? How do you want to see the international community respond? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark Berlin is an assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, where he studies international law, torture, and atrocity justice. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
It was just about a year ago, Mark, that we talked to you about U.S. calls for war crimes charges against Putin. Here we are. We have at least one from the International Criminal Court. What do you make of the release of this warrant and the particular charges made here?
Well, as the clip indicated, the charges relate to unlawful deportation of population outside of Ukraine and the unlawful transfer of a population from an unoccupied territory. Both are war crimes. This is a major milestone in the history of international criminal justice. It has to be said, this is the first time that a government official from a major superpower has been indicted by an international criminal court. And the first time in, you know, let alone a president or a prime minister. And it's the first time in the International Criminal Court's 20-year history that it's indicted someone who's not an African. So historically, it's a major development. You know, I have to be clear at the beginning here that there is basically no chance of President Putin being arrested and transferred to the court anytime soon. The International Criminal Court doesn't have its own police force. It doesn't have its own military. So it depends on the cooperation of individual states, governments, to go out and arrest indicted individuals and transfer them to the court. But that doesn't mean there are no consequences to this move, to this arrest warrant. First of all, it's hugely symbolic importance, I think, for the victims and their families. What's at issue here is the allegations of forcible abduction and transfer of children outside of Ukraine to camps and adoptive families inside of Russia. And so these charges, I think, are hugely meaningful for the victims and their family because it gives a name to the to what they've experienced. It's one thing to be opposed to this program, this policy of abducting children. It's another thing to label it as a war crime, which is something presumably the international community universally condemns. You know, it's also highly stigmatizing for Russia and for Putin in particular. It puts Russia in the same category as other infamous regimes who have also engaged in practices of abducting children and handing them out as spoils of war, spoils of political conflict to their allies. So fascist Spain, Argentina under the military dictatorship, and even leaders of Nazi Germany were prosecuted for similar practices after World War II.
Now we're seeing reports of a variety of war crimes being committed or alleged to have been committed, I should say, by Russian troops in Ukraine against Russian civilians. What makes the difference between, you know, filing charges or looking for charges against an individual, say, soldier, versus saying this is something that the head of the Russian government would be liable for?
Right. So, you know, the International Criminal Court's mission is to prosecute those with the highest responsibility for atrocities. So, you know, to the extent that that leaders at the top of the Russian government, like Putin, are responsible for this program, then it's the ICC's mission to go all the way to the top. Now, the choice of these particular crimes to single these out is particularly interesting. So I think last time I was on the show, you know, last year, right after the beginning of the war, I talked about how, you know, there's this fundamental challenge to bringing cases, these kinds of cases, that it's fundamentally very difficult to draw a line from an evidence perspective in a court from the responsibility of someone at the top, like a president, to individual soldiers at the you know, on the front lines committing war crimes. And we see a number of cases in the ICC's history of it stumbling or failing to complete cases because it faced problems in establishing this line of responsibility from the top to the bottom. Within that context, these charges, the prosecutor's decision to focus on this particular crime makes a lot of sense because this is not a crime that's being committed, say, in the fog of war where the responsibility is ambiguous. You know, the crossing the line from legitimate conduct to a war crime, you know, can be gray. And, you know, it's not clear if, you know, leaders at the top of the government are responsible for the decisions to, say, target civilians. None of that applies in this case because this is a policy that is conducted out in the open, publicly, proudly. The Russian government has promoted as a humanitarian gesture to relocate these children to Russian families. So all of the issues about who is responsible and, you know, what the facts of the potential crimes are, none of that is really at issue here. It's very clear cut. The Putin government, you know, ratified this policy explicitly, has been promoting it. And so it's not really, you know, the facts and the responsibility are not really questioned here. So it makes sense that the prosecutor here is essentially picking the easiest types of allegations to substantiate in a court, avoiding all of those normal problems that we run into at international criminal courts.
Talking to Mark Berlin, political scientist at Marquette University, looking at international criminal court charges against Vladimir Putin over the removal of civilian children, I guess obviously civilian children from Ukraine into Russia as part of the unprovoked Russian invasion of Ukraine. Mark, the international court has countries sign on as signatories. Russia is not one of them. Neither is the United States. Does that affect this decision by the ICC?
Yes, it does. So Russia is not a member of the ICC, as you mentioned. So technically, it can say that it's not legally obligated to cooperate with the court on an investigation or, say, arresting and handing over suspects. Other big countries like China also aren't members. So if President Putin travels to China, then China technically is not under an obligation, at least at this point, to arrest him and hand him over. Now, there are 123 member states of the ICC, and they are obligated to arrest anyone who's indicted by the court and hand them over. So, other Russian allies like South Africa and Brazil, who are, member of the so-called BRICS groups, group that, has regular diplomatic meetings with Russian government. If Putin travels to one of those countries, like he's supposed to travel to South Africa later in the summer for a BRICS summit, technically the South African government is obligated to arrest him and hand him over to the court. So it'll be interesting to see how Russia handles that if Putin refrains from traveling to South Africa or other ICC member states.
Before we wrap up, Mark, you mentioned China. Now, Xi Jinping, a Chinese leader, visited Moscow. He's there. That's probably been planned for a while, but it happens just after these war crimes charges are filed. Do you see that as significant? If these charges are going to make a pariah out of Putin, well, the Chinese leadership doesn't see it that way.
Absolutely. So China will play a major role in how these allegations play out politically. In theory, these allegations have, and this warrant has, the potential to increase Putin's isolation, make it harder for other countries to cooperate with him or provide him weapons. China's initial actions suggest that they are willing to give him some cover. They have denied the legality of this warrant. And there's ongoing discussions about how much China is going to provide additional weapons to Russia, which Russia really needs. So China's initial actions, suggest they are willing to give him some cover, but they're certainly going to have to take this warrant into consideration now going forward, whether they want to be seen as aiding and abetting an alleged war criminal, which also goes for other potential allies of Russia who might be considering giving them support going forward. And that goes onto the category of, the actual practical consequences of this warrant. Like I said, there's no chance anytime soon Putin will actually be arrested, but there are certain kinds of practical consequences, like difficulties with him, restricting his ability to travel around the world, potential impact on other countries not being willing to, continue to support him or support him at the same level.
Mark, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
That's Mark Berlin, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. We talked to him about the recent arrest warrant the International Criminal Court issued for Vladimir Putin and the Russian Children's Commissioner for the alleged war crime of deporting Ukrainian children to Russia. Coming up, we'll look more at what's been happening with the war in Ukraine with a UW-Russia expert. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this still on your radar after a little more than a year? What questions do you have about the latest in Ukraine and in Russia itself? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Yoshiko Herrera is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. Her research focuses on Russian politics, nationalism, identity, and ethnic politics, and international norms. Yoshiko, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
You've been listening along to the first part of our conversation, Yoshiko. What's your reaction to these International Criminal Court war crimes charges against Vladimir Putin?
Well, I think that the moral condemnation is probably the most important part. I think it also changes a little bit of the calculus for people in the West who may have been willing to cut a deal with Putin or give him the benefit of the doubt. I think it makes that much harder. So I think that it is definitely a victory for some of the victims, because not all the charges have been brought yet, but for those that the charges do affect, that is definitely a moral victory. And I think it does help strategically Ukraine make the case against Russia more broadly.
And then there's this visit, Xi Jinping of China, visiting Putin now. A lot of papers signed involving economic cooperation. How do you see this Chinese state visit as regards Ukraine, though?
I think this visit, to put it bluntly, solidifies Russia's position as a vassal state to China. The agreements are very one-sided. Russia is giving a lot to China in terms of trade, agriculture, IT, et cetera. And there's things we don't even know about yet in terms of military cooperation. And China has offered a very kind of empty sort of peace plan that says, let's just stop the fighting and, you know, hope for the best. So it's not really a peace plan that's likely to amount to anything. China did not offer any kind of serious lethal aid to Russia. They started out the visit by Xi Jinping issuing a statement saying that Russia and China are not in an alliance. So I think that the visit is very obviously one-sided, almost humiliating, in my opinion, for Russia. So I think that there were hopes, certainly on the Russian side, that they would get a lot more out of it, but I don't think that has materialized.
For the Russian people, will they even know about these International Criminal Court charges? Are they going to get the picture of Xi Jinping's visit and the deals made that you just laid out?
Well, the International Criminal Court is not held in high esteem in Russia. It's an international institution that Russia is not a party to, does not respect. And Putin's visit to Mariupol and to Crimea over the weekend kind of underscores his contempt, actually, for that judgment. So I don't think the conviction in Russia is very meaningful, except for, of course, people in the opposition. You know, it's something they would applaud, but everybody understands that Putin is very unlikely to be arrested, unlikely to travel to a country that would arrest him. So I don't think internally it makes a big difference. Putin may be trying to put a brave face on this by saying, like, well, it doesn't matter that we've cut off all relations with the West and we're never going to have a good relationship with Europe again. Look, we have this relationship with China. But I don't think that is actually a very popular position in Russia, because I don't think a lot of people in Russia are saying, great, we've always wanted to move to China and have that be the only country we can travel to. So, you know, he's trying to portray it as this relationship with China is, you know, a great victory and is a kind of a substitute for being part of Europe. But I don't actually think that's very popular.
And one concern, I think, on the Russian side is, are they going to have enough ammunition and shells to maintain the war in Ukraine? Is there any indication that some of that will flow from China?
Yes, there's already reports that, well, there are definitely reports that Russia is running out of ammunition. And actually, ammunition is a concern on the Ukrainian side as well. And there are reports that China is aiding Russia's war effort in different ways, in terms of drones, in terms of microchips, other kinds of technology. You don't get the sense of these game changers like the HIMARS or something like that. So it doesn't look like China is offering, you know, really important military assistance, but they may be offering ammunition in various ways. There are reports that Russia was getting ammunition from North Korea as well. So it's possible that they, and there were, I heard a report this morning that they're getting guns from China. So they might be getting some supplies and their war effort is being aided in some ways by China, but I don't think in a very dramatic fashion, and certainly not in what Putin and his people might have hoped for in this meeting.
Talking to UW-Madison political scientist Yoshiko Herrera about the latest news from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Yoshiko, turning inside Ukraine's borders now, the war seems to be a stalemate in the active front lines in the regions that Russia technically claimed to have annexed now. What are you looking at there?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of focus on Bakhmut, of course. Many people have said this is not actually a strategically important city, but it's become symbolically important. It's something that Russia really wants to win. This Wagner group in Russia really wants to show a victory there. And the Ukrainians have been able to hold out for quite a long time. And so it's kind of become important to Ukraine symbolically, even though it's not strategically that important. I think the biggest thing is that there were great fears of a spring offensive by Russia and what that might bring. And I think a lot of analysts have suggested that that spring offensive has sort of petered out, that it started, they didn't have much to put into it, and there's not much more coming. Now, there may be some kind of Ukrainian response, which is able to make a significant change in the battle lines and the front line, but we haven't yet seen that. So I guess I'm sort of waiting to see what the Ukrainian response is and what they might have in store. We know that there's more weapons and munitions coming, so there may be something. But I think right now both sides seem to be dug in, and analysts are kind of waiting to see what will happen.
When it comes to an end to the war, and we've talked about this in the past, Yoshiko, Russia wants pieces of Ukraine that Ukraine understandably doesn't want to give up. So negotiations don't seem likely to be successful. The possibility of a decisive victory by either side doesn't look like it's anywhere near. So what does that mean? Just long-term protracted conflict?
Well, I think that both sides at this very moment are committed to fighting. I think the International Criminal Court judgment just emphasizes one of the reasons why Ukraine is so committed, which is that they know that Russia is committing atrocities against Ukrainian citizens in the areas that it occupies. And so it's really important from a humanitarian perspective for Ukraine to retake those areas. It's not just a matter of territory, but it's a matter of coming to the rescue of their citizens in those areas. So both sides are very committed to fighting. It doesn't look like right now either side has the ability to win the war very quickly. But I think that there could be some changes coming this spring and summer with more supplies to Ukraine from the West. I think that's one of the reasons that Ukrainian officials and other supporters of Ukraine have tried to make the case that it's really important to get Ukraine the weapons it needs to win this war as quickly as possible.
And turning back inside Russia's borders now, Yoshiko, I mean, Russia was not known, I think, as a haven for free speech before all of this. Now we're seeing reports of people, you know, dragged out of bars for saying something disparaging about the war effort, a new law saying, yeah, it's illegal to criticize that Wagner group you were talking to. What effect is this having on the Russian people?
Well, for a lot of Putin supporters, it doesn't have any effect because they weren't planning on criticizing the regime. But for people who just want to talk about reality, for example, that just want to say there is a war going on, that's now a crime. You cannot use the word war. You can't say anything disparaging of the armed services or private military companies. So I think you're getting into an Orwellian situation where you're not allowed to say things that are obviously true. I think that people understand that Russia has moved further and further authoritarian, even more so than it already was since this war began, and that Putin is really maintaining his grip on power through the use of force and fear to keep people from the population from resisting his rule.
Yoshiko, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Yoshiko Herrera, professor of political science at UW-Madison. We talked to her today about some of the latest news in the ongoing war in Ukraine. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, look at the benefits of social connection and the challenges of being lonely with the author of the new book, on loneliness, how to feel less alone in an isolating world. If you have found a solution, a way to get out of a lonely period in your life, share that story now. Email ideas at WPR.org. Then join that conversation tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. We talk about cooking a lot here on Central Time on Food Friday, for example, and we often talk about the cutting edge of science and technology. Now they're coming together with a 3D printer that can make a cheesecake. As reported by USA Today, engineers at Columbia University announced the project in a science journal this week. You may have seen stuff about these 3D printers making tools, parts, toys, and such out of metals and plastics. And there have been some experiments with food as well. This is one of the more complicated ones with 7 ingredients: graham cracker, peanut butter, Nutella, banana puree, strawberry jam, cherry drizzle, and some frosting. Hang on, there's no cream cheese in that. So it's a non-cheese layer cake. Anyhow, they programmed the machine, put in the 7 raw materials. The printer produced the final creation. Why? 3D printing could be useful for astronauts, maybe the military, and yes, 3D food printers could be coming to the consumer market in the next couple of years. If I knew you were coming, I'd have printed a cake. This is Central Time.